105.9.
Hi and welcome. This is Tricia Goddard on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. And as you just heard, the show's called Talk to Tricia. So between now and 10 o'clock, we'll be tackling some of the issues that matter to you and those close to you with the help of people with first-hand knowledge and experience. Okay, coming up on tonight's show, growing up in a cult. One woman's harrowing tale of surviving the bizarre religious sect that isolated, abused and exploited her. Plus, now imagine growing up in a family where you were denied access to formal schooling, forced to beg for money, encouraged to watch adults having sex, and regularly beaten for crimes as unpredictable as reading an encyclopedia. Juliana Buring and her two younger sisters grew up in a cult called the Children of God. Sharing the same father, but different mothers, the girls were separated from each other, they were placed with different foster families around the world, and sexually and physically abused by their guardians from as early as 3 years old. While happily, the three sisters eventually broke free from the community, reunited and rebuilt their lives. Now, as adults, they've set up an organisation, Rise International, which works to protect children from abuse in cults or high demand organisations, and more of that later. Now, Juliana has also co-written a memoir with her siblings called Not Without My Sister, and she joins us live on the phone from Seattle. Now, Juliana, welcome.
Hello.
Juliana, let's start at the beginning. When did your parents first become involved with David Berg and the Children of God, and then it changed to the family? Do we call it a cult?
Oh, it's definitely what I would consider a cult. It has all of the trademarks of a cult, which is, well, they definitely were very isolated. They had extremist beliefs. They sort of dictatorship where the cult leader was the mouthpiece, and no one dares question him. There was a lot of brainwash and psychological manipulation. Yeah, I would definitely say it was a harmful cult.
With your parents, in there, just looking at the book, you describe them as, you know, often people think, oh, these must be people who are stupid to join a cult. But in fact, your father seemed to be a very bright guy. He was at university.
Yes.
And yet he got involved with the cult fairly early on, didn't he?
That's right. Yes, I think it's a misconception that that it's only, you know, stupid people or weak people who join these groups. They usually actually target middle class to upper class young people primarily, because they're usually at that time in life where they're searching for what they want to do, or they're just coming into university or coming out of university. They're alone, usually without their families for the first time. They feel vulnerable. They feel in a difficult place, or they're emotionally vulnerable. But they like to target intelligent people because they, you know, they need an intelligent workforce to work for them. So, yeah.
And yet, he believed everything, although not many people actually saw David Berg, because at that stage he was quite paranoid about people out to get him, what have you. But his writings, that was enough for your father to join.
Oh, yeah. The cult leader, David Berg, was very charismatic. He initially wrote on subjects of breaking out of the society that they saw as corrupt or dysfunctional, and they wanted to start their own utopian society outside of society at large. And around that time, when it was the hippie era, there was a lot of rebellion against their parents, against well, the Vietnam War,
against a lot
of things they saw as being wrong. So it was a very promising, very exciting message of let's break free, let's start our own great group. And obviously then they didn't think that they were joining a cult. It was only after steadily being brainwashed over the first, you know, year that they joined and the cult leaders slowly started to introduce the more heinous doctrines of, you know, sharing each other sexually, sharing children sexually, and but it took a while. It's not as if he just told them from one day to the next that they were to do this. It was something that they steadily were acclimatized to. So obviously they weren't thinking, oh, we're off joining a cult. They thought they were off, you know, joining some great communal group that shared all things, had all things common, and it was a promising message in the start, and it only deteriorated after the first few years.
And I guess people have to remember that in the 70s there wasn't CNN, internet and everything else,
right.
and there weren't
yes.
cults beforehand. This was something new and exciting and breakaway.
It was a very new phenomenon. That's right, yes, yes.
So
I think it was only coined in the 70s, I believe, the term cult.
Oh. So what's your earliest memory of life in the cult then?
Well, my earliest memories, let me see, was definitely a communal lifestyle. I think probably my earliest strong memories were of being abandoned because my parents left me because the leadership told them to, of what they called for God's work. Our father was a celebrity within the group. He was very exalted by David Berg because he had a radio ministry that went out to 2,000 stations around the world. And Berg saw this as a way of spreading the cult message and doctrine. So he didn't want our father to settle and have any kind of emotional ties with family, with children. So pretty early on, he split up our family and my sisters, who had a different mother. He was married to her, and they split them up as well. So it was sort of a trend that kept carrying on. And so then I became a ward of the group, property of the group, at 3 years old.
How old?
I was three when I was completely taken away from my parents.
But who looked after you?
Well, I was passed around to many just different foster parents or put into large, they started these schools for cult kids where all the parents just left their kids in the care of just random members, which already made it a dangerous environment because none of these people had any kind of background checks. But there was an explicit trust between membership that if you were a member, then you were a brother or a sister, and no one dared to think that they would harm their children, and they had such trust, which was very naive, I suppose. And
so were you in the same town or the same country as your father?
Not usually, no. I was sent around to about 20 different countries, and what they did is my father and mother signed some paper saying that whoever carried this paper had legal guardianship of me. And so in that way, I was literally was able to just be taken from country to country to country with this paper, and just random adults who were under the guardianship of. I didn't know who I would be taken care of next by, and it was all very confusing, very disorienting for me. And I mean, I remember showing symptoms of the trauma that I was experiencing. I mean, I wet my bed till very late in life. I was always very insecure and frightened. I never knew where I'd be whisked off to next at the drop of a hat. So it was,
In the book that you write with your sisters, you talk about at an early age watching adults, in orgies having sex, and there was the funny part where you play a game, you run up and you pinch people on the bottom while they're having orgies. But there was no problem with kids sitting around seeing sex and using sex even to beg with flirty fishing, which, and those sort of things. Did your father know that that was going on?
Yes, I believe. Well, it was all around. It was part of the doctrine of the group. David Berg came up with a doctrine called the Law of Love, where he said that that anything that is done in love is right, and that if we were all to be one wife or one family, then we had to share each other, including our bodies, with each other.
No matter how young.
Oh no! No matter how young. Well, he believed that children were sexual beings, and that that because they could orgasm, that they should not have to miss out on what he thought was a pleasurable experience. But what happened then is that the group became rife with pedophiles, and the children suffered tremendously. I mean, an entire generation of children suffered serious physical and sexual abuse because of this.
And even David Berg's family himself, they were seen as fairly incestuous, with his children and grandchildren.
That's right, yes. Well, he had incestuous relationships with his own family, and he was obviously pedophile from the start, so he created this doctrine in order to be able to carry on his, incestuous and and perverted predilections.
But what about your mother and your sister's mother? Were they okay? I mean, a man, especially if they've got leanings towards paedophilia, is one thing. Uh-huh. But your own mother, a mother and a daughter, was they had chosen to join the cult. You were born into it. Were there no protective instincts on the part of any of the mothers, seeing their children having to be touched by men and at the age of 2-3 years old?
I think that that there was two camps. There were the mothers who were actually quite unaware of it, and this is Christina's mother, who was shocked when she found out later after she left what had happened to her daughters, that she seemed to be quite removed and detached from the whole thing. Whereas other mothers that I know literally fed their children to the men, and were completely a part of it and had relationships with young boys as well. So there was the line between the two. There were members who refused to take part in it, but there was plenty who did, and it was not seen as harmful or as abuse at all. And we were told that it was love; it wasn't abuse.
I was going to say, was that confusing? Did it feel wrong? Did it feel horrible?
I mean, what happened, at least with me, is that I always sort of looked at things, and because you don't have the words to explain what you're feeling as a child, and you're told that it's right, you don't know what it is you're feeling when you feel dirty or you feel you don't want to do it, and you put up a protest about it, you would get in trouble for that. So what happened, at least to me, is whenever I felt like questioning, I would be beaten for it or punished for it or put in isolation for it. So you learn not to question, or what they call doubt, or you would suffer the consequences. So as a result of this, I began to internalize things as there was something wrong with me not being able to accept the doctrines, as opposed to something wrong with the doctrine itself.
And you were cut off from the outside world. But when your sisters and yourself going through this physical, the psychological, the sexual abuse, when did you start realizing that your parents and those people around you, your guardians, were actually crossing boundaries, that no, this was wrong? Or did you ever go through that?
Well, because we had no knowledge of the outside to compare our lives with, I didn't ever know it was wrong, even though I felt something was wrong. I didn't understand what it was. But in the early 90s is when the cult began to change this doctrine, and to say that even though the doctrine is not wrong, the outside world is bothering us about it, or there was a lot of media attention coming on to them, a lot of there began to be raids on different homes where they had reports that children were being abused, and because of that they were forced to change their policies, even though they still believe the doctrine. So that was confusing too, because they were saying you can't do it anymore, and they see it as being wrong. And that was the first time I heard, it's wrong, even though they said, well, we don't believe it's wrong, but the outside believes it wrong. So I always understood then that there was a great divide between our beliefs and what was normal, what was considered normal on the outside. And because of that, we were told, we had to lie to protect our group, or we would be taken away from our families. And from the time we were born, we were instilled with a great fear of the outside. The outside was where, the
bad and evil
were. Mm. Oh, yeah, the government and the police were the Antichrist agents of the devil. And, they would come and take us away. We were always hearing stories of martyrs, Christian martyrs, being tortured, being killed. And so that was the kind of fear that we held in our minds of the outside, or what would happen to us if we were taken away. And because we believed the end of the world was coming any day.
It was in 1993 it was meant to happen.
Yeah, in 1993, Berg said that the world would end. So we were living sort of for the end, believing we would soon die, which was terrible psychologically for a child, never to think that they have to grow up.
I was going to say, what happened in 1994 then?
Well, the cult leader died in 1994, and around that time there was a lot of, there was court cases going on against the family members.
Just to tell people, you're listening to City Talk 105.9, Talk to Tricia. I'm talking to Juliana Buring about her life as a child within the Children of God, which then became the family cult. Juliana, just coming back to you, researching on you and your sisters have put together an organization called Rise International to alert people, and going onto another website, Safe Passage Foundation, with whom we have links. They talk about HDOs, which are what are HDOs? High demand organizations. Are those what we call cults these days?
That is what we call. Well, okay. There's a bit of a confusion in the academic world. Half the academics don't want to term them cults anymore, and the cults themselves are all fighting against the term cult. And I think primarily, in my opinion, this is because it would be much harder to prosecute them in court if they are not called a cult. And also because it's gotten a negative connotation over time, primarily because their practices have been very harmful, especially as in our experience was to children who don't have the rights to education, free information, to medical care, to just grow up in a safe, loving environment with their own families. They're called high-demand organizations. This is what the cults now like to be called because it sounds better. It's more PC. And unfortunately, we live in a world where everything must be PC.
Yes.
But it is a cult.
But it is a cult. Now, they actually talk about the global population living within cults or high-demand organizations is estimated at several million.
Oh, yes. Oh, I mean, in the U.S. alone, there's over 3,000 cults, and I know there's a few hundred in the U.K. Oh, the cults are thriving more than ever because, I mean, they're now trying to gain credibility in the public, and people are becoming more desensitized to the idea of it. And so, at least for us, you know, we obviously the cults, so a lot of them can't, you know, when they try and, you know, children or people who are harmed by them try and take them to court or prosecute them, they are able to get away with literally murder by crying, oh, our right to religious freedom. And you know, we can do what we like because this is our religion and this is our belief. What I believe is that there's got to be a balance found between protecting the right to religious freedom, but at the same time protecting children from damaging or criminal behavior that is justified by religious doctrine.
And also that's covered by the United Nations as well, anyway, isn't it?
Yes, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And while I recognize that parents and guardians have certain rights, including the rights of religious freedom, those rights cannot be exercised in a manner that violates the inherent rights of children. And children do have rights, and more this is, you know, I think it's only in the last 20 years that children's rights have really become such an issue.
Absolutely. But how did you get away? How did you and your sisters get away? And why get away? I mean, what spurred you, for instance, to make a break for it? How old were you?
Right. Well, I was in my early 20s when I left. And I actually stayed as long as I did. People always ask us, why did you stay as long as you did?
Yeah.
There are various reasons that makes it difficult for second-generation children born and raised in these groups to leave. And, of course, one of them is fear of the outside world. When you leave, you are cut off from all your family and friends on the inside, and you are basically thrown out into this world that you have no preparation for. You don't know anything. You don't have an adequate education.
You don't have any boundaries, do you?
You have no boundaries. You don't even know yourself yet as a personality. What is your beliefs? What do you like and dislike? Because you're so, you've only ever espoused what the cult believes or the group believes.
That would make you very, very vulnerable to being abused because you don't know who to have sex with, who not to have sex with. You believe anything that's told of you. That makes you very vulnerable, doesn't it?
Very much so. And I've seen that it makes all the difference when these kids leave is if they find just one good person who helps them walk them through just the basic steps of how to get themselves set up, how to, you know, write a check, how to get a bank account, how to register for a social identity number.
Did you have that?
I found, when I left, I came across two very good people who helped me out and who basically saved me because, I mean, there are so many predators who are just waiting to catch those kind of prey when they leave. And so I've seen that the kids who survive and make it and become successful are those who have just one good person they meet outside or a family member on the outside. But those who don't survive, who fall into deep depression or suffer post-traumatic stress disorder or can't cope on the outside and very often commit suicide, these are the kids who immediately are caught up by some predator as soon as they leave, and they fall into bad situations instantly. So it's a make or break in the first year when they leave.
Do you have family members? Do you still have family members within the cult?
Oh, yes. Well, both my parents are still in the group.
So you've had no contact?
Well, I did try and keep contact. When I first left, I left in Africa, and I got myself a job and an apartment nearby because I have five young brothers and sisters still living there with my father, and I wanted to be nearby and keep contact with them, and I wanted them to know that I'm, you know, I'm there for them on the outside if they ever need me or they ever want to leave. But then, obviously, after we wrote the book, our father has tried to sever all contact with our family, our brothers and sisters. And, well, early this year, actually, I just flew over there because he was hanging up the phone when I tried to call them. So I just flew over there, and it was my little brother's birthday, and I set up with a friend there to take them all out for dinner. I just showed up, and so I was able to see them.
How was that, though? How was that?
Oh, well, it was lovely for me and for them. I mean, they were screaming. They were so excited, and I had presents for them all, and it was lovely. And our father, he didn't say a single word the entire dinner. He was just white like a ghost. He was shocked, and he couldn't believe that I had, you know.
Have you seen your mother, did you say?
Yeah, I haven't seen her in years. But she does write me emails from time to time, and she's much more accepting of my choices in life as opposed to our father, who has basically called us demon-possessed and refuses to speak with us at all. So
but
it's
has
quite a contrast.
Has the sexual abuse stopped within the group, or do you know, is that an open question?
Yes. Well, I believe that it's not, well, it's no longer a accepted policy. They no longer practice it. However, many of the same sexual predators and abusers from in the past when they were still practicing it are still in the group and, in fact, leaders in the group. And the problem with this is that pedophilia is a sickness. It doesn't go away just like from one day to the next. You decide you no longer have those desires. You know, it's something that you have to be treated for. And so the problem is that the group protects these people, and they haven't turned them over to any authorities, to any police, and so it's inevitable that this is going to happen again at some point. It's going to pop up again, and when it does, the group has a very firm policy against going to authorities, to police, to anybody about any kind of abuse that occurs, and they deal with it internally, almost like the Catholic Church used to do. And it's almost a mafia idea of what happens in the family stays in the family. And so in this way, I don't believe it's still not a safe environment for the children, because children are still passed around. There is no background check of the people who care for the kids. They still don't get adequate education. They're not allowed to go to school. And they don't get adequate medical care either. So I still don't believe that it's an entirely safe environment for the kids, even though some of the more extreme practices have discontinued.
Okay, we should tell people that both your organisation, Rise International and Safe Passage, some of the very valuable
yeah.
work you do as with protection agencies, because often their way of approaching things is fairly heavy-handed and sends these cults into their shells, whereas you know probably the more the Achilles heel and the more subtle ways in which to approach them. So if people are concerned, because I'm amazed at how big the population is living within cults around the world, if people are concerned about a family member or a child or somebody who has been indoctrinated into a cult, what should they do? Can they contact Rise or Safe Passage or
They can contact us. They can contact us. There's a couple other cult awareness agencies. There's a great one in the UK called FAIR, which informs people about different cults, and they can contact them. They can contact us. And I mean, we do believe that, you know, oftentimes when the police do come down too heavy-handed, it's just simply because there's a lack of information out there. And I think it's so important that people become informed of what to expect. And also that if these groups want to retain a degree of legitimacy within society, that they need to be more transparent and institute internal child protection policies. And I think this would go a long way towards easing the mind of the public and law enforcement agencies, that they are doing their best to create safe environments for children in the groups.
Okay. Juliana, thank you so much. We should just tell people again, the book is called Not Without My Sister. It's not all doom and gloom, because I believe it's a real true story of resilience, and indeed you've gone on to do some amazing work. And it's interesting when a lot of these groups identify with God and God's work, in reality, I'm sure most people listening would realise that those of you who've managed to get away and doing what you do are far closer to God's work than the cults from which you escaped. So more power to you. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Talking to
Thank
us. Okay, so as I said before, the book's called Not Without My Sister. Juliana Buring and her sisters wrote that book. You've been listening to City Talk 105.9, Talk to Tricia. It's been fantastic having you join me, and I'm sure you'll agree we've heard from some truly amazing people. So, hey, have a fantastic week, and join me same time next Sunday at 8 o'clock. I'll be looking forward to being with you then. Until then, bye-bye.